With that, we are ready to start this session. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to keep your phones on mute, and again, do not put us on hold. The speakers today will be introduced by Monica Ramirez. Ms. Ramirez is the Research Translation Coordinator for the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program. She has experience moving information and technology from researchers into the hands of decision makers at all levels. Some of her activities include building linkages and partnerships with U.S. and Mexican government agencies, creating innovative bilingual communication tools, and conducting informal learning experiences for people of all ages. She has an MPA in Environmental Science and Policy from Columbia University. Monica?
Thank you, Justin. Thank you for that introduction. Again, the overall goal of the Research Translation Corps for which I represent is to actively communicate research products generated by the Superfund Research Program to pertinent audiences and stakeholders in the most appropriate and effective manner. To improve these efforts, there is a short survey at the end of this seminar called Improving Collaborations Among Academic Institutions and Remediation Stakeholders. That link is called SurveyMonkey link that you'll see on the last slide. It would be greatly appreciated if you could complete the survey, and the results will definitely be put to good use. I'm happy to announce it and to be part of the EPA SRP seminar series, which is the result of an ongoing collaboration and collaborative efforts between EPA's Region 9 Superfund and Technical Liaison, Mike Gill, and myself. Mike Gill and I discussed and delineated the scientific needs of the regional project managers, as well as the research strengths of the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program, and we put together designed an information transfer series that has two parts. One is called Live at Region 9, where investigators present at Region 9 headquarters, and the second part is an internet seminar, which we're about to hear, that incorporates input from the live presentation. Due to the great success of our collaboration and seminar series, Gil and I have opened this seminar series to all the Superfund research programs within Region 9, on the West Coast. So with that said, we are delighted, on behalf of Mike and myself, we are delighted that Dr. Miller from University of California, Berkeley, and Dr. Steinmoss from the California Environmental Protection Agency will be presenting today. I will give their introductions as well. Dr. Mark Miller currently serves as the director of the University of California San Francisco Pediatric Environmental Health Specialty Unit, as a public health medical officer for the California EPA Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, Air Pollution, Toxicology, and Epidemiology Section. At the California EPA, Dr. Miller is working on developing risk assessment methodology that addresses the unique vulnerabilities of children. Recently, he has edited a review of the health effects of environmental tobacco smoke for the California Toxic Air Contaminant Listing Process. Dr. Miller has served as a member of advisory committees and expert panels in the area of pediatric environmental health for the state of California and federal agencies. His articles on pediatric environmental health issues have appeared in such publications as Pediatrics, Environmental Health Perspectives, and Preventative Medicine. Our other speaker, Dr. Craig Steinmoss, is a public health medical officer and epidemiologist at the California Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. He is a faculty member of the Division of Epidemiology at the University of California, Berkeley, and of the Division of Occupational and Environmental Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. He co-teaches several classes at the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley, including casual inference and meta-analysis and occupational and environmental epidemiology. He has performed numerous National Institute of Health-funded epidemiological studies on the health effects of drinking water contaminants such as arsenic and perchlorate. He is currently the Associate Director of the Arsenic Health Effects Research Program at UC Berkeley, which conducts local and international research projects on arsenic. He has performed published research studies on other common environmental and occupational contaminants, including benzene, formaldehyde, and beryllium. With that, we are excited to hear the presentation. I will pass it over to the speakers.
Yeah, this is Mark Miller. I hope you can hear me. Thank you for having us today on this seminar. And we'll move to slide 2 and then immediately to slide 3. I think for those of you who are not familiar, I wanted to make sure that that I introduced the pediatric environmental health specialty units, which are funded as a collaboration between the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and ATSDR. And you'll see that on this slide three, that there are PESUs, as we call them, in each of the EPA regions, at least one. Several, such as Region 9, have subunits, so that we have one at UC San Francisco and a second that's at UC Irvine. The PACEUs are a collaboration between occupational environmental medicine, pediatrics, and clinical toxicology. We're available for clinical consultation, and we do a lot of education of physician, nurses, and other clinicians, and as well for consultation with government agencies. Moving to slide three, my portion of the talk today is really to give you some background information on thyroid physiology and concerns about susceptibility of the fetus to interference with thyroid hormone system. And then Craig will go on, and hopefully with this background, you'll be able to better interpret some of the epidemiology of perchlorate. So it's been well recognized for a very long time, over 100 years, that thyroid hormone was important for mental development. This could be seen in areas of endemic goiter where there is also cretinism, which is a disruption or a lack of thyroid hormone during fetal and early childhood development, resulting in often profound mental retardation. The thyroid system is kind of a classic feedback endocrine regulatory feedback system, so that thyrotropin-releasing hormone is released from the hypothalamus, which ultimately stimulates from the pituitary gland thyroid-stimulating hormone, TSH, which stimulates the thyroid gland to actually produce thyroid hormones, which are known as T3 and T4. And then feedback from having adequate levels of thyroid hormone in your body feeds back to the brain, telling it to reduce production of a thyroid hormone. It's essential for essentially all cells in the body. If you click again on slide five, there's a figure that comes up. Unfortunately, due to the Kluin system, you don't see this, but it has little balls that are circulating and feeding back to the hypothalamus, showing this system. And also a note that during the first trimester of pregnancy, the fetus is not making thyroid hormone, and so for that reason, it's totally dependent upon maternal thyroid hormone levels. Thyroid hormone does cross the placenta and is important even in very early development. I guess another click brings on those little balls, and yet one more takes you to slide number seven. The ability to transport and concentrate iodide from the blood is absolutely necessary for the synthesis of thyroid hormones. So this is facilitated by what's called the sodium iodide symporters. This is active transport, bringing iodide ions into the thyroid gland. Now, these are inhibited. They're competitively inhibited by perchlorate, thiocyanate, and nitrate. And in fact, perchlorate has a much greater affinity than does iodide for the simp order. So in other words, this concentrates the iodide that's in the blood into the thyroid gland. If you'll click again, slide 8, it shows you why this is so important. Onto this protein, the thyroglobulin that is in the gland, iodide molecules are added using the enzyme thyroid peroxidase. And you have to add 3 or 4 of these iodide molecules, atoms, to make a T3 or T4. So it's a stepwise process adding iodide molecules. The on the right is thyroxine with 4 iodides. That's T4. So if you had 3 of those little green iodides, that's T3. These are the active thyroid hormones. Actually, in the cells, T4 is deiodinated to T3, which is generally the more active form. If you click again, we go to slide 9. And the thyroglobulin is then packaged and diffuses into the blood. But the point of this slide really is that all of this process of bringing the iodide into the thyroid gland, adding it to the thyroglobulin, packaging the thyroglobulin, you take the T3 or T4, T4 off of the thyroglobulin and package it for diffusing into the blood, all of those are stimulated by TSH. So when your T4 in the blood goes down, remember we have a feedback mechanism, causes your TSH to go up, trying to tell the thyroid gland to produce more thyroid hormone. And each step of the way is stimulated by that TSH. Next slide, number 10. The brain develops not only during fetal growth, but actually postnatally. Full development of the brain really doesn't occur until the mid-20s or so, with all of your executive functions intact. But there's multiple processes that need to happen. So you have to proliferate cells, then cells migrate, then they form synapses and myelinate. Each of these things happen in a sequence that's a kind of a cascade. You can't migrate the cells until you've proliferated those cells to have them. It's very important. And so the concept of a window of susceptibility for neurodevelopment is key to understanding some of our concerns. An example of this is thalidomide. Thalidomide, at least those of you who are a little bit older will remember as a sleeping medication that was specifically marketed to pregnancy and never actually okayed by the FDA and used in the United States, but used in much of the rest of the world, resulting in severe limb defects. It was also noted to have an increase in autism related to it. It turns out that going back and looking at the French cohort, Patricia Rodier was able to identify that there was in fact an increase in autism only in those exposed between about day 20 and 24 of gestation. So there was a window of susceptibility that was quite important and only in that time period. Next slide, slide 11. So we look at some of those developmental processes that are essential, and different toxicants that actually interfere with those processes. And you can see that thyroid hormone uh, is is a problem for almost all of those, as is ethanol, another neurotoxicant that's been well defined. Those aren't the only chemicals, but I just put those as examples. Slide number 12. So the concern about neurodevelopment, you know, is longstanding. We know that thyroid hormone is extremely important, and it wasn't though until this paper by Dr. Haddow in 1999 that the level of concern was really raised. And this, you look retrospectively at thyroid-stimulating hormone in pregnant women in the middle of their pregnancy. And out of these 25,000 odd women, they had 48 that had high TSH levels. Right, so that would correspond with low T3 or T4 levels in general. And compared those to 124 match controls. And what they saw was that at 7 to 9 years of age, that there were deficits in intelligence and attention. So that translated to a decrease of about 7 points in IQ. Now, these women had high TSH, low T4 levels, above the 98th percentile. And I'll go to the next slide. POP has a couple of, actually three publications, two listed here, that look at actually an even finer group. So elevated TSH, low T4, those are actually, mildly hypothyroid, patients. Now, in this next study, what POP looked at was the lowest 10th percentile of free T4 with normal TSH. So this somehow wasn't enough lowering. I mean, these generally would be considered normal or hypothyroxemic, but not hypothyroid, because they're in the lowest 10th percentile of T4, but without elevating the TSH. Anyhow, they looked at those levels at around 12 weeks gestation, and then followed the children of these mothers with controlling for various other issues, and found a decrease in IQ of about eight IQ points at 2 years. This was confirmed in an additional study in Canada, where they only followed, at least published, they've only followed them out about 6 months, where they do a newborn behavioral assessment. Slide 14. So this is to give some background on why we ought to be concerned about perchlorate and thyroid. So we know that perchlorate blocks iodide uptake into the thyroid gland. We know that the combination, I think Craig will go into this a little bit more, a combination of low iodide and perchlorate are additive kinds of factors. But we know from this small study in Boston that iodide in breast milk is, in fact, a concern, where they looked at breast milk and found iodide content that particularly in smokers, was quite low. We know actually from NHANES that somewhere in the range of a third of women of pregnancy age are consuming less than ideal amounts of iodide. This was increasing in the 80s and 90s, and apparently has leveled off at this point. Some of these mothers also had very high levels of perchlorate in the breast milk. And as well, infant formulas contained perchlorate in this study up to 4 micrograms per liter. The breast milk was even higher than that. Go on to slide 15. So the Institute of Medicine considers adequate iodide intake to be 110 to 130 micrograms per day, and it was estimated that as many as 47% of the nursing women in the study may be providing insufficient iodide to their infants. And the median perchlorate level was 9.1 micrograms per liter. Slide 16, you'll see that the reference dose was is 0.7 micrograms per kilogram per day. And this is a separate study that looked at formulas, and you can see that some of the dairy-based formulas, infant intakes would be as high as 0.23 micrograms per kilogram per day in this study, and as much as more than double that in the previous study by Pierce. So that in these formula-based calculations, this is using perchlorate-free water. Using the formula, infants get a relatively significant dose. But then take that and consider that here the highest perchlorate in the formula was 1.8 micrograms per liter, and in the median in the breast milk in the Pierce study was 9. Micrograms, so over four times that much, which would put you substantially over the RFD. Next slide, number 17, not related to the neonatal issues, but I just thought we should introduce that there are other issues with thyroid hormone. The top figure A, shows increasing diastolic breast blood pressure, and I think it's not labeled well on this slide, but I think women are the bottom line and men are the top. You know, as you elevate your TSH, which means decreasing your thyroid sufficiency, your blood pressure elevates pretty much linearly. And the bottom part of that figure B, you see change in low density lipoprotein with change in free T4, and as your T4 goes up, or in other words, as you get more sufficient in T4, you see a decrease in your low density lipoprotein. In other words, a more favorable lipid profile, protective for heart disease. Slide number 18. What does all this mean? Well, I think it's, we'll just look at the top figure A. This looks at serum cholesterol and then, deaths from coronary heart disease. So if you look at the line that says individual risk, the little dashed line, as your cholesterol goes up, as you all know, your individual risk for coronary heart disease goes up significantly. The higher your cholesterol, the more risk. However, if you look at the blue columns, the highest number of people that are affected by cholesterol are actually at the lower levels of cholesterol. And even though the individual's risk is much less as you go down in cholesterol levels, the population risk, in fact, increases because there's so many more people that have a cholesterol of 220 or 230 than have 340 or 350. And then if we go to the next slide, this is my last slide, slide 19, add on to that, and this may explain some of the reason we see results like POPs where there's evidence of some impact of low T4 that's actually within the normal population range. And that is if you look at the larger bell curve, the higher one, that's a population normal range for thyroid, you know, goes from 50 to 150 or so nanomoles per liter. And then what they did in this study is do multiple thyroid hormone evaluations over a period of year for a group of patients, and they were able to determine the individual normal variation. And so the range of normal for an individual is that smaller bell-shaped curve within it. So it's only you as an individual, your hormone normal range is only a small fraction of the total population range. So what that means is you may have a thyroid hormone value, T4, for example, that it registers as normal for your population range, but for you as an individual, it could perhaps be low. And that ends my set of slides, and we can move on to slide 20 with Craig, unless there are some questions.
If anyone has questions, you can go ahead and take your phone off mute by pressing star 6, state your name and organization, and go ahead and ask your question. Also, simulcast participants can submit questions using the question mark icon. We'll just wait for about 10 seconds. If there are no questions, we will continue.
Let me add that I don't know, Craig, if you've put these up yet, but I did forward two or three papers that review some of this from environmental health perspectives. It should be up on the website either now or soon.
Correct. Those are up on the website. They are already up. So if you go to the related links and at ClueIn in the seminar webpage, you will be able to see the three publications that Mark is referring to. I am not getting any questions from the simulcast participants. One more try. If you're on the phone and have a question, go ahead and take your phone off mute and ask your question. Okay, it sounds like we can go ahead and turn the time back over to Monica. Monica, did you already give the introduction? I'm sorry.
Yes, I already gave Dr. Simons' introduction.
I apologize, I missed it because I was dealing with the phone issue, but all right, let's go ahead and proceed. Thank you.
Okay, hello everybody, this is Craig Simons. So I'm starting on slide number 20. My portion of the talk, I'm going to start by just giving a little bit of data on perchlorate exposure, and then I'm going to go into a few of the human epidemiological studies. And I'm going to focus on human studies for a couple of reasons. One is because I'm an epidemiologist, and that's what we do. And also, there's some data out there that suggests that humans are not the same as rats or mice in terms of perchlorate sensitivity. So that's why I focus on human studies. Anyways, getting back to exposure, there's data that suggests that essentially everybody in the United States is exposed to at least some level of perchlorate. In a recent analysis of NHANES, which is essentially a nationally representative sample, perchlorate was found in the urine of every person that was assessed, at least at some level. And I'll go into those data a little bit more in a second here. But the primary routes of exposure are through food and water. And you can see on slide 20, there's some data there about a recent survey by the US FDA where they did, again, sort of nationally representative survey of perchlorate levels in various foods collected from grocery stores and fast food restaurants throughout the United States. And in their survey, they found detectable levels of perchlorate in 213 of the 286 foods assessed. And on slide 20, I give a sample of some of the foods and the perchlorate levels that they found. Some of these data disturbed me a little bit. I wasn't especially disturbed by perchlorate in spinach or cauliflower, since I don't eat them, but I was especially disturbed by perchlorate in french fries, bacon, and apple pie, since those are some of my favorite foods. But anyways, you can see some foods have relatively high levels of perchlorate. So moving on to the next slide, slide 21. There isn't a good, thorough national sample of perchlorate levels in drinking water in the United States, but this slide shows the data from California, and it shows various counties in California, and each county has multiple sources of drinking water, and it shows the number of sources of drinking water in each county that had detectable levels of perchlorate, or at least levels greater or equal to 4 parts per billion. The column over on the right is the not the average exposure, but it's the peak perchlorate exposure. This table tells us that there are a lot of water sources that have some perchlorate in them. It doesn't give us a good idea of how many people are actually exposed, because we don't have, or I don't have, the data that links each source to the number of people drinking that source. But I think it gives a good indication that there may be a fair number of people in this country that have perchlorate in drinking water. So as Mark was saying, I'll move on to the next slide, slide 22. As Mark was saying, the mechanism of perchlorate, and we know that at high doses, that perchlorate inhibits iodine uptake, and that can lead to a decrease in T4, or thyroid hormone, and that can subsequently lead to an increase in TSH. In the past, perchlorate has been used as a medicine. Because of this mechanism, perchlorate has been used as a medicine to treat hyperthyroidism. At a relatively high dose. It's not used as a medicine anymore for a variety of reasons. But the table that I show on slide 22 shows some of the studies that looked at doses of perchlorate that are lower than the medicinal doses. And you can see from this table that most of these studies haven't found any evidence of a clear association between these somewhat lower doses of perchlorate exposure and impact on thyroid hormone levels. Now, a couple of them, I believe the top two, found that these levels of perchlorate that I show in the table did impact iodine uptake, but it wasn't severe enough to cause a detectable decrease in thyroid hormone. Now, as I think Mark sort of implied in his lecture, there may be some people that are more susceptible to perchlorate than others. And one potential problem of some of these studies that I show in slide 22 is that a lot of them included only healthy volunteers or working population and didn't necessarily focus on susceptible populations. So moving on to slide 23, one of the first studies that looked at a susceptible population and found an effect was a study by the CDC. Ben Blount was the lead investigator. He may be on the line here, so Ben, you can correct me if I say anything wrong. But this was a study of perchlorate levels in urine and serum levels of thyroid hormones that were collected in about 2,300 people as part of the Ann Haynes survey that occurs every 2 years. And again, this is essentially a nationally representative sample. And perchlorate, detectable levels of perchlorate were found in every sample tested. But I think an important point of this study was that the levels were low. Since it was a nationally representative sample, it didn't specifically focus on a high exposure population. The overall median exposure level was pretty low. You can see here on slide 23, it was just under 3 micrograms per liter. So the next slide, 24, shows the results of this study. And these are regression coefficients, in other words, the slope of the relationship between urinary perchlorate and thyroid hormone levels, both T4 and TSH. And you can see in men, essentially, we found no effect, or CDC found no effect. In women, they looked at women with low iodine and women with higher iodines, with the hypothesis that if you have a low iodine, since that's the mechanism of perchlorate, you may be more susceptible to perchlorate. And you can see in this chart that there was effects on both T4 and TSH. In other words, in women with low iodine, as the perchlorate levels increased, the regression coefficient is negative for T4, which means T4 levels decrease. So increasing perchlorate, decreasing T4, and also increasing perchlorate caused increasing TSH in women with low iodine. And the TSH finding was also seen in women with higher iodine. Now, I think an important point about these results are, again, nationally representative sample, relatively low levels of perchlorate, and also this susceptible population, or potentially susceptible population, women with low iodine, is not a small fraction of the population. It was actually included 37%, about 37% of all women in this study. Okay, the next slide, 25, I just, a very simplistic view of what was seen in the CDC study. Again, you know, increasing perchlorate, decreasing T4, and increasing perchlorate and increasing TSH. Very simplistic. The data were much more scattered than this nice clear line I show. Now moving on to the next slide, 26. There were some strengths and some weaknesses of the CDC study. One of the strengths was that individual data on perchlorate and thyroid hormone levels was available. It wasn't ecological data. In other words, it wasn't based on a drinking water level where we don't know if the woman is drinking the water or not. This was actually perchlorate levels in the urine, so individual data. Another strength of the findings was that they're biologically plausible in one sense, in that they're consistent with the known mechanism of perchlorate. Perchlorate, at least at high levels, is known to decrease T4, increase TSH, and that's what was found. Perchlorate is known to act by inhibiting iodine uptake, and it was found that the effects seem to be greater in women with low iodine. Thiocyanate is also a iodine uptake inhibitor. And in a paper that Mark and I published, we took the same data set and we saw that there was a synergistic effect between perchlorate and thiocyanate in affecting thyroid hormone levels. So all of these findings are consistent with the known biological mechanism of perchlorate. Now, not necessarily consistent with what's known about the dose of perchlorate, but definitely consistent with the mechanism. There were some questions, and one question is, well, the doses are so low, and I showed you previously that a lot of these studies really showed no effect at doses that were high, much higher than seen in the CDC study. So that was one question. Other questions were, we didn't see a synergistic effect with nitrate. That's another known iodine uptake inhibitor, and we're not exactly sure why. And moving on to the next slide, 27, other questions were, what about misclassification of the outcome measure, T4, TSH, or misclassification of perchlorate? This study was based on a single measurement of T4 and a single measurement of perchlorate. We know that these levels in urine and in serum can change on a day-to-day basis or even within a day in an individual. So if we take a single spot measurement of perchlorate, that doesn't necessarily mean that perchlorate level is completely accurate in assessing long-term perchlorate levels. So there may be some misclassification. And also some criticisms of the study. What about the possibility that these findings were not due to perchlorate, but actually due to some confounding variable that might also affect thyroid hormone levels? So I looked at being an epidemiologist and being interested in assessing causal inference. That's what I teach. I wanted to look at each one of these aspects of causal inference. And so moving on to the next slide, 28, I looked at the possibility that these results could be due to misclassification of perchlorate exposure or misclassification of thyroid hormone levels related to taking a single sample. But a basic principle in epidemiology is that if you're collecting samples from people the same way, Everybody gets their urine collected the same way. Everybody gets their blood collected the same way. If you misclassify your exposure variable or your outcome variable, the most, by far the most likely direction of that bias or any error that's caused is going to be towards finding no effect. Not towards causing a false effect, but towards finding no effect. And I kind of give you an example in slide 28. This is a made-up example. And let's say that we do a study, and we have very good estimate of long-term T4. This is the top of the slide that I show you. Very good estimate of T4 and a very good estimate of perchlorate exposure. And let's just say there is a relationship that we see. Now, what would happen if our measurements of T4 and perchlorate were not perfect? And what would happen if there was some misclassification? And I took it to the extreme. What would happen if our measurement of T4, instead of giving us a perfectly accurate indicator of long-term perchlorate exposure, it actually gave us a completely random number? In other words, somebody who really has a high T4 for a long period, and we assess their T4 levels by a completely inaccurate measure, so they may have end up with a high T4 in our measure, our inaccurate measure, or a low T4 in our inaccurate measure. So it's a completely random number. What would happen to our relationship? And you can see at the bottom half of the slide, if we misclassify T4, we're going to get a random measurement of T4 throughout, and we'll lose our association. That slope that's downsloping in the upper part of the slide will now be flat, and there'll be no evidence of an association. And the same thing happens if we misclassify perchlorate exposure. We'll lose our association. So the bottom line is, this idea that misclassifying or inaccuracies in assessing our T4 and perchlorate by using a single sample, the most likely bias would be towards the null. They wouldn't have caused the effect that we see. Now, there are some exceptions to that rule, that this misclassification bias is towards the null. There are some exceptions, but they're very rare, and they don't really apply to these data. Okay, next slide, 29. I also looked at, or I wanted to evaluate, what about the impact of confounding? Now, the CDC results were adjusted for multiple confounders. And so I actually was able to get the data because it's publicly available, and I looked at these numbers as well. And what I did, or what I'm showing on slide 29, was the furthest bar over on the left is the fully adjusted regression coefficient between perchlorate and T4. Now, the regression coefficient was negative. I turned it into a positive just to make the slide look a bit better, but it's about 0.81. And what I did was I then took each potential confounding variable that was adjusted for, and I took them out one at a time to see if they would make a difference. If they're truly strong confounders, most likely we would see a big change in the regression coefficient. And you could see, for each one of these confounders that I list on the bottom, none of them really changed the regression coefficient all that much, except for maybe nitrate changed a little bit, but there was still a statistically significant relationship between perchlorate and T4 after nitrate was removed from the model. And I also did this, I also took the unadjusted regression coefficient and added each variable one at a time, and the same thing. None of the potential confounder variables that were entered in the model made much difference. So, why was that? If they're potential confounding variables, how come they don't really change the relationship between perchlorate and thyroid hormone levels? Well, the reason is that a confounding variable, most likely reason, is that a confounding variable has to be related not only to the outcome measure, T4, it also has to be related to the exposure, perchlorate. Many of these variables, I'm on slide 30 now, many of these variables that were adjusted for are related to thyroid hormone levels, but they aren't necessarily related to perchlorate. And if they're not related to perchlorate, they won't cause significant confounding. Now, other people have brought up the idea that there may be other variables that weren't adjusted for. PCBs is one example that may be causing confounding in this analysis. And PCBs, there is some literature that links PCBs to thyroid hormone levels, but I haven't seen any data linking PCBs to perchlorate levels. And so I'm not convinced that PCBs could be a potential confounder unless, you know, there are some data
that link PCBs to perchlorate levels. So I think that's kind of an important point that I wanted to get across. If we're worried about potential confounding variables causing these results, you know, we would like to know not only if they're related to thyroid hormone levels, but are they related to perchlorate levels as well? Okay. All right, so moving on to the next slide, 31. As Mark was saying, we think the fetus is highly susceptible to even relatively small changes in thyroid hormone levels. And so we think that may be a susceptible population. Now, there aren't any human studies on perchlorate exposure and thyroid hormone levels in the fetus for obvious reasons, ethical and technical reasons, but there are studies that have looked at perchlorate exposure in the mother's drinking water during pregnancy and thyroid hormone levels in the newborn. And I list several studies down at the bottom of slide 31. One issue with these studies, I believe, is that several of them removed or excluded thyroid hormone levels that were assessed in the first 24 hours. These studies used thyroid hormone levels that were measured in newborns as part of state-mandated screening programs. So there actually are data available from, for example, in California, from every infant or every newborn, it's mandated that they have their thyroid hormone levels checked. So there are a lot of data out there on these newborn thyroid hormone levels. Moving on to slide 32. As I was saying, a lot of these studies that looked at perchlorate exposure in mother's drinking water and newborn thyroid hormone levels removed levels, thyroid hormone measurements that were collected in the first 24 hours. Now, why did they do that? A couple of reasons. One is there's this surge in thyroid hormone levels that occurs specifically, or especially, I should say, in TSH. Right after birth, TSH levels shoot up very high. They peak at about 30 to 60 minutes after birth, and then they gradually fall back down to normal after about 3 or 4 or more days. There's also somewhat of a peak in T4 levels, as you can see on, again, slide 32, but this occurs a little bit later and it's not nearly as traumatic. So you can see the TSH is the dotted line there. So moving on to slide 33. So the reason why these studies didn't look at the first 24 hours is a couple of reasons. One is because there's this high surge, especially in TSH, it was felt that if you look at high levels of TSH in the first 24 hours, that would lead to a lot of false positives for diagnosing congenital hypothyroidism, especially hypothyroidism that required treatment. So these screening programs were aimed at picking up kids who were hypothyroid that would need treatment. So if you assess TSH levels too early, you'll get a lot of high levels and a lot of false positives, and that would lead to a lot of children being unnecessarily treated, perhaps. Another reason to throw out these first 24 hours is that if you do have this spike in TSH levels, you'll get a lot of variability, and that variability may mask any true effect. Okay, as I show at the bottom of slide 33. Okay, so moving on to slide 34. So it gives the results of these studies that assess the relationship between mother's drinking water perchlorate level and thyroid hormone levels in the newborns. And there's both TSH and T4 results here. And you can see in these studies that throughout the first 24 hours, they didn't find really any evidence of an association between perchlorate exposure and newborn thyroid hormone levels. Okay, moving on to 35, which is kind of my major point here, is that those studies I just showed you throughout data from the first 24 hours, it may be possible that the first 24 hours shouldn't be thrown out, and actually maybe should be the focus of these studies. They may actually be the most relevant. And the reason being is because these studies looked at the perchlorate level in the mother's drinking water during pregnancy, not at the water or breast milk that the newborn was fed, but the water that was used by the mother during pregnancy before birth. Perchlorate level, or the half-life of perchlorate and the half-life of thyroid hormone levels are short, less than a day.
and perchlorate exposure may change at birth. In other words, before birth, the mother is the sole source of perchlorate to the fetus. But after birth, that exposure may change in the child because the water in the hospital may be different than the water at the mom's residence. The infant may be put on formula that may have a different perchlorate level than the mom's residential drinking water supply. The mom or the formula may have, mom may drink bottled water or the formula may be drink bottled water, so the perchlorate exposure can change right after birth. And because the perchlorate half-life and thyroid hormone half-life are short, that may cause you to lose an effect. Now, the next slide, I sort of give an example of that. And that would be slide 36. And again, this is another made-up example, but let's say you did a study where you're looking at mother's maternal perchlorate levels in their drinking water. In the top half of the slide, I have a, let's say I have a group of eight women and their fetuses, and the drinking water perchlorate level is greater than 5 parts per billion. Now, after birth, and each one of those 8 is exposed. That's the E in the chart. Now, after birth, before birth, the perchlorate level to the child is solely dependent on what comes from the mother. After birth, however, like I was saying, that perchlorate level can change. So now, a fetus that was exposed or from an exposed region may now be unexposed. For example, if they switch to a formula that doesn't have perchlorate in it. So you can see a lot of the exposed can switch to the unexposed. And let's say you have a population down the second, the lower half of this slide, an unexposed population, or exposed to lower doses of perchlorate. If the exposure changes, a lot of those unexposed fetuses can become exposed when they're children. So if the exposure changes in enough children, then you'll lose any relationship between mom's drinking water perchlorate level during pregnancy and the newborn thyroid hormone levels. So that's why I think it's actually important to assess thyroid hormone levels within the first 24 hours and not wait too long. The longer you wait, the more the chance and the more likelihood that perchlorate exposure is going to change in the child and obscure any relationship that exists. So, moving on to 38. So what I did was I tried to find as much data as I could on the relationship between mother's drinking water perchlorate level during pregnancy and thyroid hormone levels within the first 24 hours after birth. And that's what this shows, a selected group of the results that I found. And there were, this slide shows 4 different studies where I did find associations between mother's perchlorate level during pregnancy and thyroid hormone levels, either an increased TSH or a decreased T4 in the newborn within the first 24 hours after birth. Now, some of these data, the lower two Schwartz, was actually for all children, regardless of the age when TSH was measured. But in that study, a large fraction of all infants had TSH levels and T4 measures within the first 24 hours. I think it was 37%. And some people have criticized looking at the first 24 hours of TSH levels, saying that they may not be a representative sample. But again, a large fraction of women in the state of California, again, it's about 35 to 37% of newborns have their TSH levels measured in the first 24 hours. Okay, so moving on to the next slide, slide 39. So getting back to the reasons for not looking at the first 24 hours or TSH measurements collected in the first 24 hours, again, that may lead to false positives. Well, I agree. If your goal is to diagnose congenital hypothyroidism that was going to require treatment with thyroid hormone, I agree. Looking at data within the first 24 hours can cause a lot of false positives for that because of the surge in TSH. However, that's not our goal. Our goal is to see if perchlorate exposure might lead to changes in the developing child. So we are more interested in even more subtle effects than frank, overt congenital hypothyroidism. And then also the argument that the increased variability during the TSH surge may invalidate results. But again, the bias
if you have all this misclassification and variability, the error or the bias will be towards not finding anything, not towards causing a positive effect. Okay, moving on to slide 40, just to summarize. So, a lot of people are exposed to perchlorate through either food or water. Most studies show that for healthy, normal adults, relatively high doses don't seem to impact perchlorate exposure. However, as Mark was saying, and as I think we found, there may be some susceptible subpopulations. I think when looking at studies of perchlorate, we do need to consider the physiology, the fact that perchlorate and thyroid hormone level half-lives may be short. And I think there is some evidence to suggest that perchlorate during pregnancy can impact thyroid hormone levels in the developing child. And I think we need more research on those effects and on effects in the fetus. Okay, that's it.
Great. Thank you very much, Drs. Miller and Steinmoss. Before we open the question and answer session to the presenters, I wanted to make sure everyone is aware of the links page, the survey that Monica mentioned previously, and the online feedback form. If everyone goes to slide 41, you will see links to those three things. The links page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive that will be available on the CLUIN webpage. Also associated with the links page is the online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. Links to the additional resources page and the feedback form can be found on the last slide of the presentation, as I just mentioned. Also on the last slide of the presentation is a survey developed by the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program titled Improving Collaborations Among Academic Institutions and Remediation Stakeholders. Please take a moment to fill out that survey. I will now open the question and answer session. For either presenter, if you have a question, please take your phone off mute, state your name and organization, and ask your question. And again, you may have to press star 6 to take your phone off mute.
Okay. Larry Ladd.
Go ahead.
Hi, Larry Ladd with the Community Advisory Group for Aerojet Superfund Site Issues out in Sacramento. Three questions for Dr. Steinmaus. I read your paper on looking at potential synergistic effect with thiocyanate, and I wonder if you've talked with anybody about, a physiologist or an endocrinologist, speculate about what mechanisms that might be. So two come to mind. First would be that perchlorate inhibits the detoxification of thiocyanate. Inside the thyroid, thiocyanate is converted from thiocyanate to sulfate. And the last stage of that series of enzymes is sulfide oxidase, which is a component of the nitrate reductases that break down perchlorate in plants. So if somehow perchlorate was inhibiting that process and sulfite was accumulated inside the thyroid, that would be toxic. The other thing, the question I've always had about this process for the last 13 years is I see no discussion about perchlorate enhancing the efflux, the removal or the diffusion out from the thyroid of iodine. And so that's another question I have in terms of potential mechanisms. The other thing is, do you have any comment? I saw the abstract, the last Blount study, that suggested that sodium iodide symporter in the placenta is not concentrating perchlorate in the fetus. So I wonder if you had any impact or comment on that. And then lastly, just comment on the Redland study, where they have a range of 0 to 10 parts per billion. I know for a fact that the well that was shut down in the Hispanic part of Redlands had like over 100. So I'm just for your information. So anyway, the question about, have you talked with folks there at Berkeley about potential synergistic effects?
No, I haven't. My hypothesis is that thiocyanate and perchlorate work by the same mechanism. They both inhibit the NIS, and that seems to be a plausible mechanism for this synergistic effect. Two agents coming at the same toxic site, basically. As far as your other questions, I think that most of them are actually a little too deep for me. And again, you know, I'm more of an epidemiologist and not a physiologist, so I don't think I can answer those questions about the efflux of iodine or the increase in sulfite. You make a very good point about Redlands, and I think that's a point in general, is a lot of these times it's really hard to assess the actual exposure. A lot of it's based on ecological data, and we don't know exactly what people were drinking and how many people were drinking it. That data isn't readily available.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Catherine Kurtz from the Navy Public Health Center. Excellent presentations, and appreciate having the opportunity. I just wanted to bring up a point, and it's been a while since I've looked at the story, so forgive me if I'm speaking in error, but when you're talking about what you just said, Doctor, about the ecological, regardless of what might or might not have been in drinking water, there's also what is in food that the mother or whoever may have ingested that actually may be higher than what was in the water. So it's difficult, you know, to draw a conclusion when you don't really have that component. But Dr. Blount was a co-author, and I believe he might be on the line, and I'm just going to refer to his New Jersey study, I believe, which is published, where he's a co-author, where there was actually before delivery and after delivery, they have actual measurements from the mother and the child, and also the placenta and the cord blood. And also, I there was a study, which I just have some notes on, from also a Pennsylvania hospital, which NIEHS, I believe, also is a co-author. And I also just wanted to, and I believe, you know, the points about thiocyanate and nitrate also are in food. So it's kind of a complicated picture. We at the Public Health Center are very concerned about any potential impacts to developmental impacts, of course, and to minimize them as much as possible. And, you know, you might have, the mother may have been drinking bottled water. So I think, you know, what you just said about more research is definitely absolutely needed, and it's very interesting, and I hope more studies are funded. Thank you.
So, I had a, those are good points. I had a couple of points that I wanted to make in response, and one is that so these studies that look at drinking water and thyroid hormone levels, you're absolutely right. They don't, some of them don't have, or most of them, or maybe even all of them, don't have data on food exposures. But as an epidemiologist, the first question I always ask myself is, well, what is the bias, and what is the direction of the bias? So in these studies that look at drinking water, if we're unable to incorporate the chloride from food, the bias is most likely to be non-differential and towards the null. So again, an epidemiologist, I like to look at the direction of the bias towards the null. So it wouldn't cause, it'd be very unlikely to cause a false effect. The second thing is that in the CDC study by Ben Brown, you know, that was urinary perchlorate. Urine is the primary exclusion pathway of perchlorate. So that's going to take into account all sources, food and water.
I wasn't talking about the NHANES study, sir. I'm talking about 09 new paper from New Jersey.
Yeah, I thought you had mentioned food. Okay, so to get to that, that paper, Ben Brown is on the line and would like to comment.
I just thought it was an interesting paper, and I, you know, since it wasn't mentioned in the presentation, I'm just mentioning. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any more questions?
There are several questions that came in from the simulcast participants. We can start up at the top. This was asked regarding the first half of the presentation. This was from Malcolm Siegel of Sandia Labs in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Why is high TSH associated with low T4?
This is basic physiology. This is the, I was trying to get this idea that it's a feedback mechanism where, you know, the central nervous system sees that there is a decrease in your thyroid hormone and homeostatically, you know, puts out the messaging, hormonal messaging via TSH to tell the thyroid gland to modulate up the T4. These are how these are related. It's interesting, actually, for a number of chemicals, though, what you often see in epi studies is that chemicals that interfere with T4 that give you small modulations, decreases in T4, often do not show an elevation in TSH. So that's in fact is what you see for whatever reason, you know, small modulations like, you know, less than a 25% decrease in T4, may have a negative outcome in the POP study with neurodevelopment without taking your TSH out of the normal range. Go.
Thank you. We can stick with Dr. Miller. We have one more question right here regarding slide 13. This is from Juanus Boyskowski of OEPA in Columbus, Ohio. What is useful coefficient of variability in IQ measurement in two-year-old children? Change of 8 IQ points.
There is a correlation between, you know, IQ measured early and later. I'm not sure how to answer this more than that. I'm not interested in decreasing my two-year-old's IQ by 8 points. You know, what is the ultimate, I guess this question really is saying, well, what does that mean for, you know, adolescent or adult IQ? How well does that track? Well, you know, there's a number, obviously, of other things that go factor into ultimate IQ. What I can say is that from studies of some chemicals associated with IQ loss, that it, both in animal studies and in human studies, there's evidence that an enriched environment does ameliorate the effect of you know, the impact on these things. So that would mean that, you know, something you measure early with a later enriched environment, good preschool, good home environment, etc., that IQ loss over time may be ameliorated. But, you know, from other studies, such as lead studies, you see that early IQ is predictive of deficits later. I think we have to leave the answer as a general one like that.
Great, thank you. We can go back to the phone line to see if there are any questions queued up there. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute and go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, this is Terry Craig from EPA.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Hi, this is Terry Craig from EPA, Region 10. I had a question on the nitrate covariance. It seems like that, if anything, is probably one of the slightly stronger associations on this. Has there been any studies that looked at iodine inhibition directly just from nitrate, you know, taking the perchlorate factor out of that?
Yes. I'm not overly familiar with those studies, but there are studies that do show that nitrate is a NIS inhibitor.
Yeah, I think there's a good study comparing iodide, thiocyanate nitrates by, I don't know how to pronounce the name, Tonacera, something like that, T-O-N-A-C-H-E-R-R-A, I believe. I believe, if I remember correctly, as far as, you know, competitive inhibition sodium iodide symporter, it goes perchlorate, iodide, thiocyanate, nitrate as far as potency.
So the relevance of those data to human exposure and to a urinary nitrate level are unknown.
So in the case of, let's say you had, you know, nitrates maybe 1,000 or even 10,000 times higher than the perchlorate, would you be able to take both of those into consideration when you're looking at inhibition?
Well, again, you know, like, for example, when we looked at thiocyanate perchlorate, we looked at the Van Braun data, and the nitrate levels are urinary nitrate levels in a single-spot urine sample. And so I don't know that we can that is necessarily, that single spot urinary level of nitrate, I don't know that that is necessarily relevant to what actually happens at the thyroid and at the NIS.
But additionally, you know, in our paper, this is Mark North, we looked at thiocyanate specifically in NHANES and the impact of perchlorate on thyroid hormone is the slope of the impact is greater in those with more thiocyanate present. So there is some additive or synergistic effect.
Okay, thank you.
This is Catherine Kurtz again. I just wanted to mention that the Blau co-authored two new hospital studies also measured thiocyanate and nitrate, I believe, and they had it in breast milk and in the urine, and it just was interesting to see which of the goitrogens had a greater effect on the thyroid hormone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's take another question from the online participant. Let's see, this question is from Amy Bishop of BHE Environmental in Cincinnati, Ohio. The question is, all the thyroid tests were conducted in the late 60s and 70s. I know the studies were concentrated on drinking water, but were any of the participants smoking at the time? And if so, what impact would the perchlorate and cigarettes have on the study?
I don't know. That's a good question. We were more concerned about the thiocyanate coming from the smoking. But I haven't seen data showing that the levels that you would get from smoking are that high. I haven't seen those data.
Okay, thank you. We're going to stick with the simulcast questions. Here is another from Stephen Kloss of Haley and Aldrich Incorporated in Manchester, New Hampshire. The question is, since many women are known to be iodine deficient and because perchlorate directly competes for iodine uptake and vice versa, why not address this apparent public health risk proactively and reintroduce the iodination of bread? This would also alleviate many non-perchlorate sequelae in newborns and early childhood.
Well, yeah, I agree that if there is an iodine deficiency problem, that should definitely be addressed. However, I don't know that is relevant to perchlorate. My feeling is that if you have a chemical exposure that may be causing an effect that you don't want, the best way to deal with that is to reduce the exposure to that chemical, not to treat it with something else. So I think reduction of perchlorate exposure would be a much more effective measure than adding another chemical like iodine.
I think, you know, another issue is iodide in itself is not entirely benign, and so that you have to be careful in adding too much, because large dose of iodide in itself can reduce thyroid hormone function, thyroid hormone production.
We've got one more question that's actually really relevant to what you're speaking about right now. This is submitted by Stephanie Hansen of Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The question is it feasible and or cost effective to monitor, test for, and treat municipal water supplies?
I don't think that's our area of expertise, in all honesty.
I think that's somebody at EPA or a water supply company who might be able to answer. Yeah, we deal mostly with the health effects. But that is an excellent question, though, is the cost.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. Are there any more questions from phone line participants? Okay, we have one more question from the simulcast participants. This is from Malcolm Siegel from Sandia Labs again. Misclassification leads to bias toward the null in individual level studies, but away from the null in ecologic studies in cases of non-differential misclassification. How does this affect our ability to draw conclusions from studies involving drinking water exposure to perchlorate?
Well, again, we're looking at, the association between perchlorate and thyrochlorone levels. And this misclassification, if it's non-differential, it could increase an association that's there, but it wouldn't cause a false association. So that's what I'm looking at. Is the chemical exposure causing the effect? And that bias, potential bias in ecological studies that the caller had mentioned, wouldn't cause a false effect. It might potentially increase it, but it wouldn't cause a false effect. I mean, it might potentially increase a true effect, but it wouldn't cause a false effect.
Okay, while you're answering that one, we've got one more question. Have leafy vegetables reported greater perchlorate levels than fruits or meats? And this question is from Russell Bartlett in the California Department of Public Health.
Yeah, again, I don't know. I just know that perchlorate's in a lot of different foods, and grouping it like that, I don't know. But I can tell you that data that I showed on one of my slides from the U.S. FDA, that is publicly available. So you can go on their website and find that, and it lists all 286 foods. So if there's particular food groups you're interested in, that data is on that website.
Yeah, I believe that the higher perchlorate levels have been seen in produce that comes from arid regions. There is a natural perchlorate in the soil.
Right, thank you. If there are no more questions at this time, the participants can contact Dr. Miller and Dr. Steinmoss via email with additional questions. Their email addresses are on the additional resources page. If you submitted, we feel good. No more new questions. So to conclude, I would like to thank Monica Ramirez and Mike Gill for organizing this web seminar and our presenters, Dr. Mark Miller and Dr. Craig Steinmoss. With that, this concludes today's presentation. Thank you for your participation.